world for his inspection. Now the level had sunk so far that the broken mast of the old wreck was climbing into the air, its weeds hanging limply from it as they lost their liquid support. Jeff hastened forward, eager to see what wonders would be uncovered next. It was then that he noticed the sound from the reef. He had never heard anything like it before, and he stopped to think the matter over, his bare feet slowly sinking into the moist sand. A great fish was thrashing in its death agonies a few meters away, but Jeff scarcely noticed it. He stood, alert and listening, while the noise from the reef grew steadily around him. It was a sucking, gurgling sound, as of a river racing through a narrow channel. It was the voice of the reluctantly retreating sea, angry at losing, even for a moment, the lands it rightfully possessed. Through the graceful branches of the coral, through the hidden submarine caves, millions of tons of water were draining out of the lagoon into the vastness of the Pacific. Very soon, and very swiftly, they would return. One of the salvage parties, hours later, found Jeff on a great block of coral that had been hurled 20 meters above the normal water level. He did not seem particularly frightened, though he was upset over the loss of his bicycle. He was also very hungry, as the partial destruction of the causeway had cut him off from home. When rescued, he was contemplating swimming back to Athens, and unless the currents had changed drastically, would doubtless have managed the crossing without much trouble. Jean and George had witnessed the whole sequence of events when the tsunami hit the island. Though the damage to the low-lying areas of Athens had been severe, there had been no loss of life. The seismographs had been able to give only 15 minutes warning, but that had been long enough to get everyone above the danger line. Now the colony was licking its wounds and collecting together a mass of legends that would grow steadily more hair-raising through the years to come. Jean burst into tears when her son was restored to her, for she had quite convinced herself that he had been swept out to sea. She had watched with horrified eyes as the black, foam-capped wall of water had moved roaring in from the horizon to smother the base of Sparta in spume and spray. It seemed incredible that Jeff could have reached safety in time. It was scarcely surprising that he could not give a very rational account of what had happened. When he had eaten and was safely in bed, Jean and George gathered by his side.
"Go to sleep, darling, and forget all about it," said Jean. "You're all right now."
"But it was fun, Mummy,"
protested Jeff.
"I wasn't really frightened."
"That's fine," said George. "You're a brave lad, and it's a good thing you were sensible and ran in time. I've heard about these tidal waves before. A lot of people get drowned because they go out on the uncovered beach to see what's happened."
"That's what I did,"
confessed Jeff.
"I wonder who it was helped me."
"What do you mean? There wasn't anyone with you. The other boys were up the hill." Jeff looked puzzled.
"But someone told me to run."
Jean and George glanced at each other in mild alarm.
"You mean you imagined you heard something?"
"Oh, don't bother him now," said Jean anxiously, and with a little too much haste. But George was stubborn. "I want to get to the bottom of this. Tell me just what happened, Jeff."
"Well, I was right down the beach by that old wreck when the voice spoke."
"What did it say?"
"I can't quite remember, but it was something like, 'Jeffrey, get up the hill as quickly as you can. You'll be drowned if you stay here.' I'm sure it called me Jeffrey, not Jeff, so it couldn't have been anyone I knew."
"Was it a man's voice? And where did it come from?"
"It was ever so close beside me, and it sounded like a man."
Jeff hesitated for a moment, and George prompted him. "Go on. Just imagine that you're back on the beach, and tell us exactly what happened."
"Well, it wasn't quite like anyone I've ever heard talking before. I think he was a very big man."
"Is that all the voice said?"
"Yes, until I started to climb the hill. Then another funny thing happened. You know the path up the cliff?"
"Yes."
"I was running up that because it was the quickest way. I knew what was happening now, for I'd seen the big wave coming in." It was making an awful noise, too, and then I found there was a great big rock in the way. It wasn't there before, and I couldn't get past it.
The quake must have brought it down, said George.
Shush!
Go on, Jeff.
I didn't know what to do, and I could hear the wave coming closer. Then the voice said, "Close your eyes, Jeffrey, and put your hand in front of your face." It seemed a funny thing to do, but I tried it. And then there was a great flash. I could feel it all over, and when I opened my eyes, the rock was gone.
Gone?
That's right. It just wasn't there. So I started running again, and that's when I nearly burnt my feet because the path was awful hot. The water hissed when it went over it, but it couldn't catch me then. I was too far up the cliff. And that's all. I came down again when there weren't any more waves. Then I found that my bike had gone, and the road home had been knocked down.
Don't worry about the bicycle, dear, said Jean, squeezing her son thankfully. We'll get you another one. The only thing that matters is that you're safe. We won't worry about how it happened. That wasn't true, of course, for the conference began immediately after they had left the nursery. It decided nothing, but it had two sequels. The next day, without telling George, Jean took her small son to the colony's child psychologist. He listened carefully while Jeff repeated his story, not in the least overawed by his novel surroundings. Then, while his unsuspecting patient rejected seriatim toys in the next room, the doctor reassured Jean.
There's nothing on his card to suggest any mental abnormality. You must remember that he's been through a terrifying experience, and he's come out of it remarkably well. He's a highly imaginative child and probably believes his own story. So just accept it and don't worry unless there are any later symptoms. Then let me know at once.
That evening, Jean passed the verdict on to her husband. He did not seem as relieved as she had hoped, and she put it down to worry over the damage to his beloved theater. He just grunted, "That's fine," and settled down with the current issue of stage and studio. It looked as if he had lost interest in the whole affair, and Jean felt vaguely annoyed with him. But 3 weeks later, on the first day that the causeway was reopened, George and his bicycle set off briskly toward Sparta. The beach was still littered with masses of shattered coral, and in one place the reef itself seemed to have been breached. George wondered how long it would take the myriads of patient polyps to repair the damage. There was only one path up the face of the cliff, and when he had recovered his breath, George began the climb. A few dried fragments of weed, trapped among the rocks, marked the limit of the ascending waters. For a long time, George Gregson stood on that lonely track, staring at the patch of fused rock beneath his feet. He tried to tell himself that it was some freak of the long-dead volcano, but soon abandoned this attempt at self-deception. His mind went back to that night, years ago, when he and Jean had joined that silly experiment of Rupert Boyce's. No one had ever really understood what had happened then, and George knew that in some unfathomable way these two strange events were linked together. First, it had been Jean, now her son. He did not know whether to be glad or fearful, and in his heart he uttered a silent prayer. "Thank you, Karelin, for whatever your people did for Jeff, but I wish I knew why they did it." He went slowly down to the beach, and the great white gulls wheeled around him, annoyed because he had brought no food to throw them as they circled in the sky. Chapter 17. Karelin's request, though it might have been expected at any time since the foundation of the colony, was something of a bombshell. It represented, as everyone was fully aware, a crisis in the affairs of Athens, and nobody could decide whether good or bad would come of it. Until now, the colony had gone its way without any form of interference from the overlords. They had left it completely alone, as indeed they ignored most human activities that were not subversive or did not offend their codes of behavior. Whether the colony's aims could be called subversive was uncertain. They were non-political, but they represented a bid for intellectual and artistic independence. And from that,
who knew what might come? The overlords might well be able to foresee the future of Athens more clearly than its founders, and they might not like it. Of course, if Corellon wished to send an observer, inspector, or whatever one cared to call him, there was nothing that could be done about it. 20 years ago, the overlords had announced that they had discontinued all use of their surveillance devices, so that humanity need no longer consider itself spied upon. However, the fact that such devices still existed meant that nothing could be hidden from the overlords if they really wanted to see it. There were some on the island who welcomed this visit as a chance of settling one of the minor problems of overlord psychology, their attitude towards art. Did they regard it as a childish aberration of the human race? Did they have any forms of art themselves? In that case, was the purpose of this visit purely aesthetic, or did Corellon have less innocent motives? All these matters were debated endlessly while the preparations were underway. Nothing was known of the visiting overlord, but it was assumed that he could absorb culture in unlimited amounts. The experiment would at least be attempted, and the reactions of the victim observed with interest by a battery of very shrewd minds. The current chairman of the council was the philosopher, Charles Yan Sen, an ironic but fundamentally cheerful man not yet in his 60s and therefore still in the prime of life. Plato would have approved of him as an example of the philosopher-statesman, though Sen did not altogether approve of Plato, whom he suspected of grossly misrepresenting Socrates. He was one of the islanders who was determined to make the most of this visit, if only to show the overlords that men still had plenty of initiative and were not yet, as he put it, fully domesticated. Nothing in Athens was done without a committee, that ultimate hallmark of the democratic method. Indeed, someone had once defined the colony as a system of interlocking committees. But the system worked, thanks to the patient studies of the social psychologists who had been the real founders of Athens. Because the community was not too large, everyone in it could take some part in its running and could be a citizen in the truest sense of the word. It was almost inevitable that George, as a leading member of the artistic hierarchy, should be one of the reception committee. But he made doubly sure by pulling a few strings. If the overlords wanted to study the colony, George wanted equally to study them. Jean was not very happy about this. Ever since that evening at the Boyces, she had felt a vague hostility towards the overlords, though she could never give any reason for it. She just wished to have as little to do with them as possible, and to her, one of the island's main attractions had been its hoped-for independence. Now she feared that this independence might be threatened. The overlord arrived without ceremony in an ordinary man-made flyer, to the disappointment of those who had hoped for something more spectacular. He might have been Corellon himself, for no one had ever been able to distinguish one overlord from another with any degree of confidence. They all seemed duplicates from a single master mold. Perhaps, by some unknown biological process, they were. After the first day, the islanders ceased to pay much attention when the official car murmured past on its sightseeing tours. The visitor's correct name, Thanthalteresco, proved too intractable for general use, and he was soon christened the Inspector. It was an accurate enough name, for his curiosity and appetite for statistics were insatiable. Charles Yan Sen was quite exhausted when, long after midnight, he had seen the inspector back to the flyer which was serving as his base. There, no doubt, he would continue to work throughout the night while his human hosts indulged in the frailty of sleep. Mrs. Sen greeted her husband anxiously on his return. They were a devoted couple, despite his playful habit of calling her Xantippe when they were entertaining guests. She had long ago threatened to make the appropriate retort by brewing him a cup of hemlock, but fortunately this herbal beverage was less common in the new Athens than the old. "Was it a success?" she asked as her husband settled down to a belated meal. "I think so, but you can never tell what goes on inside those remarkable minds. He was certainly interested, even complimentary. I apologize, by the way, for not inviting him here. He said he quite understood and had no wish to bang his head on our ceiling." "What did you show him today?"
"The bread-and-butter side of the colony, which he didn't seem to find as boring as I always do.
He asked every question you could imagine about production, how we balanced our budget, our mineral resources, the birth rate, how we got our food, and so on. Luckily, I had Secretary Harrison with me, and he'd come prepared with every annual report since the colony began. You should have heard them swapping statistics. The inspectors borrowed the lot, and I'm prepared to bet that when we see him tomorrow, he'll be able to quote any figure back at us. I find that kind of mental performance frightfully depressing. He yawned and began to peck half-heartedly at his food. Tomorrow should be more interesting. We're going to do the schools and the academy. That's when I'm going to ask some questions for change. I'd like to know how the overlords bring up their kids, assuming, of course, that they have any. That was not a question that Charles Sen was ever to have answered, but on other points the inspector was remarkably talkative. He would evade awkward queries in a manner that was a pleasure to behold, and then, quite unexpectedly, would become positively confiding. Their first real intimacy occurred while they were driving away from the school that was one of the colony's chief prides. "It's a great responsibility," Dr. Sen had remarked, "training these young minds for the future. Fortunately, human beings are extraordinarily resilient. It takes a pretty bad upbringing to do permanent damage. Even if our aims are mistaken, our little victims will probably get over it. And as you've seen, they appear to be perfectly happy." He paused for a moment, then glanced mischievously up at the towering figure of his passenger. The inspector was completely clothed in some reflecting silvery cloth, so that not an inch of his body was exposed to the fierce sunlight. Behind the dark glasses, Dr. Sen was aware of the great eyes watching him emotionlessly, or with emotions which he could never understand. "Our problem in bringing up these children must, I imagine, be very similar to yours when confronted with the human race. Would you agree?"
"In some ways," admitted the overlord gravely. "In others, perhaps a better analogy can be found in the history of your colonial powers. The Roman and the British empires, for that reason, have always been of considerable interest to us. The case of India is particularly instructive. The main difference between us and the British in India was that they had no real motives for going there, no conscious objectives, that is, except such trivial and temporary ones as trade or hostility to other European powers. They found themselves possessors of an empire before they knew what to do with it, and were never really happy until they had got rid of it again."
"And will you," asked Dr. Sen, quite unable to resist the opportunity, "get rid of your empire when the time arises?"
"Without the slightest hesitation," replied the inspector.
Dr. Sen did not press the point. The forthrightness of the reply was not altogether flattering. Moreover, they had now arrived at the academy, where the assembled pedagogues were waiting to sharpen their wits on a real, live overlord.
"As our distinguished colleague will have told you," said Professor Chance, Dean of the University of New Athens, "our main purpose is to keep the